Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Order Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:56 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 10th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term, audio and video for the various different asset classes. Everyone wants to talk about the trade war and what does that mean for assets? What does it mean for the stock market, the bond market, the currency markets? Are we at the dawn of a new Cold War? And I think those are all very important questions, but when I think about what does all of this mean in terms of the much bigger picture, then there were other news items that were out there today that were, I think, rather important. Well, the first one is that Virgin Galactic is getting ready to not, they're not worried any longer about the technology that's going to take commercial space flight and space tourism. They're thinking about outfitting it and how to create the best, most comfortable experience for the people that are going to drop $250,000 to take the first flights. That's really a very profound change in terms of the global economy, because it is opening up the dawn of a completely new investment sector. And most of the companies that are involved are still privately held. This was also the week in which we saw Jeff Bezos yesterday saying that he wants to take Blue Origin to the moon. So that is also a rather important development. What we also saw earlier this month was that the Israeli team that had been competing in the Lunar X Prize did get their Moonlander to the moon, but it crashed. And probably because of the lack of funding more than anything else, because that was a real shoestring budget. I don't think we could consider Amazon's founders' pockets to be quite as shallow as the poor chaps that had their lander disintegrate on landing on the moon. But what it does suggest is that there is competition to get this done, and there is real progress to be shown. We do have now got reusable rockets, and that was pioneered by Elon Musk. So it isn't simply that there is one company doing this. In fact, there is competition among private individuals to get their own companies off the ground, literally. Well, then of course there are state backed operators, most particularly in India and China. And they are also committing themselves to additional investment in space. Well, there are going to be communication, military, tourism, manufacturing, biotechnology implications for all of these sectors, and potentially even mining. There's been this far out ambition to mine asteroids for at least the last 10 years. But in the last couple of months, what we've seen is that the a Japanese team were the first people to fire a projectile at an asteroid with the aim of collecting debris to see what was under the surface. That is probably the first step in the ambition to start mining asteroids. So when we start to think about everything that's happened in simply the last 3 months, this gives us a clear idea of the orbit in which this sector is moving, because the pace of innovation, the pace of achievement, and the, I guess, the runway to potential revenue streams is really picking up pace. And that is a profound bull market hypothesis. If we start to think about the kinds of secular themes that can evolve from commercial space flight and the potential for these companies to start delivering on free internet for the entire world, for the potential for manufacturing in space, for the potential for mining operations on the moon, for example, then there is also the potential that you've got helium-3 in large quantities on the moon, which is potentially a significant fuel for fusion reactors. And then, of course, you have the whole fusion story. So fusion has always been 25 years away. Well, now it's looking increasingly like it's about 10 years away. So there have been significant innovations in terms of how to contain the plasma field. That has been achieved through innovations in supercapacitors. And when you look at what is now possible, then the reason that the cost of innovation has come down so abruptly, that the ITER machine that is being constructed in Provence in France, which has required tens of billions of dollars of capital to be committed by all of the largest countries in the world to try and get it done, that has led to really quite impressive technological innovations in order to get the first one completed, and it's not yet complete. But because of the innovation that has happened in supercapacitors, then what we now see is that the team at MIT say they can do it for about $200 million. Well, that's an order of magnitude lower than what was possible or even potentially envisaged as possible 20 years ago. The pace of innovation has improved to such an extent. Then, of course, you have the application of massive data crunching. Now, there was also news in here this week that within the next year, the first exabyte supercomputer is going to be completed at the Lawrence Livermore laboratory. And that is going to be up to 15 times faster than the next fastest supercomputer globally. The primary thing that it is going to be focusing on is crunching the numbers for physics, healthcare, and environmental questions, because the data sets that we're talking about are profoundly large and that it requires massive computing power to try and get that done. Mapping the human brain, for example, has not yet been completed because it takes almost the entire computing power of Google to simply map one brain. And that is a massive quantity of data. So the quantity of data that is in the healthcare sector is orders of magnitude larger than anything that we've ever had to deal with before. Well, these types of advances, this ability of big data, artificial intelligence, and other really quite impressive computing power feats also have the potential to fuel secular bull markets. I think these are some of the most important things to pay attention to. Now, when we think about that as the pace of technological innovation, one of the other things that people are talking about is automation. And automation is also an offshoot of artificial intelligence. It's also an offshoot of data management and acquisition and processing. But it's as equally, it's dependent on communication. And the rollout of 5G, which is going to happen this year, is another step change in terms of communication speeds. It's what I tend to think of as an enabling technology, because it is going to enable massive additional sources of revenue stream creation from faster communication. The potential that we're going to have autonomous vehicles within the next 5 years is a very real one. The fact that we are at a point where we have much greater efficiency on the horizon, because electricity production to fuel batteries is more efficient than simply putting petrol in each individual car. There is obviously going to be a massive infrastructure built to try and get the recharging capacity up so that we can have enough of chargers for all of the cars that are going to be produced. But there is massive investment going into battery production facilities. Once that the once all of those batteries are on the market, then we're going to have every auto manufacturer in the world producing electric vehicles. There are currently 500 different producers of electric vehicles in China alone. They're not all going to survive. That's almost for certain. But what that also helps to ram home is the point that it is considerably less expensive to produce an electric vehicle than an internal combustion engine driven vehicle, for the simple reason that you require one third the number of parts to produce an electric vehicle. So the barrier to entry is falling. Where the real intellectual property is going to reside is with the battery manufacturers. Again, this is a sea change in terms of the efficiency in the market. These are the kinds of innovations, technology-led innovations, that are driving a secular bull market in terms of technology. Well, I think this is one of the most important things to bear in mind, because when we then go back and think about the Dow Gold ratio, well, we have had three very significant peaks in the last 100 years. There is 35 years between each of the peaks on average. The last peak was in 1999, therefore, just in linear progression, the next peak should also then be 35 years hence, so somewhere in the mid-2030s. And it should be higher than the last one, because we've had higher highs over the last 100 years. Well, what that suggests is that by the time this secular bull market has run its course, then the Dow will be trading at more than 50 times the price of gold. Well, gold at present is, well, let me get you the exact price. Gold at present is trading in the region of $1,285. So that would put, if we were just simply going to accept that gold was not going to move, and of course that is completely fallacious, but that would put the Dow well in excess of 60,000 points. So that's, I think, a rather impressive advance, but it also tells us that the stock market is likely to continue to outperform the commodity market over the course of the next 20 or 15 years. But nonetheless, gold prices are in a base formation, and they are steadying from the region of the trend mean. Now, there has been a downward bias over the course of the last while. Now, the fact that we do have this rounding characteristic in terms of the gold price, the fact that it does look like there is base formation underway, well, that is suggestive that people are looking at the potential for there to be some sort of deflationary effect or inflation, something that is going to create negative real interest rates, which would then make the argument for owning gold all the more impressive, because it doesn't pay an interest rate and can't simply be lent into existence. Well, that brings us then back to what is it that is going on in the world today, and how does that fit into the much bigger picture? Well, then there is I think a rather important point. I did see a graphic in here today. I'm going to pull it up for you. But what I found particularly interesting is when we think about the outlook for the global economy, there is the very, very significant question right now of whether we are seeing the relative peace in the world order, the play along to get along way of doing business that has been conducted now for the last 30 odd years. Well, what that is, I think, beginning to suggest is we're at a point where now we can ask these questions. Now, The big question is really, with China rising and representing a threat to the established world order, are we going to have a war? Well, the Thucydides case studies suggest that historically there has been a risk of war, but not really since the dawn of the nuclear age. So you had the Soviet Union and Japan, you had the USA and the Soviet Union, and then these are these significant questions, whether we're going to see war in the nuclear age, and what we definitely have had in the period since the mid-20th century have been proxy wars. So the proxy wars have allowed major powers to fight one another without going to war directly. All of the damage from those wars has taken place in third-party countries rather than in their domestic countries. There is no reason to think that that is not exactly what we're going to continue to see because of the threat of mutual destruction. But that is assuming that there is a threat, a credible threat of mutual destruction. If, on the other hand, that mutual threat disappears, then we have, obviously, we're going to have an arms race. So the evolution of the defense sector is also something that is worth paying attention to. The fact that space is also likely to become a theater of war is another factor that represents a risk. The creation of kinetic weapons, so weapons that are not 100% relying on the power of a nuclear explosion, but rather simply being the analog of an asteroid falling to Earth because they are traveling at such enormous speeds that whatever they hit is going to be obliterated. Well, those types of weapons have already been created by the USA and by China and Russia. They are at least I think they're an example of the kinds of alternatives that are being created. What it really does ram home is that this space is going to be a fresh theater of war in the next period of global turmoil. Now, the big question is, what is going on between the USA and China? China has benefited enormously from the creation of, or from its accession to the World Trade Organization. I think that's probably the best way to think about it. And when we think about what China has been able to do, well, it's really quite simple. They have been able to access international markets without allowing international markets access to their domestic market. That's been going on for nearly 20 years. The net effect of that has been manufacturing jobs have migrated to China. So that's, I think, a very significant factor. Now, one of the most important points about manufacturing is that it is generally a highly elastic market. Now, if we simply, and I think the chart of manufacturing employment in the USA tells us a really profound story. Because what we anticipate from manufacturing data is that during an economic expansion, manufacturing jobs should increase because demand increases, therefore production increases, and employment increases. And that's exactly what we saw in the 1970s. When you had economic expansions, you had big moves upwards in employment in the manufacturing sector. You also then anticipate that during a recession, a lot of factory workers will lose their jobs because there isn't the same demand. Factories close, inefficient operations get rationalized, and that's also what you anticipate. Well, That was also part of the reason why manufacturing workers generally got paid double the minimum wage. So that was one of the primary avenues where manufacturing workers were able to achieve a middle-class standard of living. And that was the primary conduit through which people that had not been successful in the schooling system or were not especially academic were able to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. But since China entered the World Trade Organization, then this ebb and flow in the fates of manufacturing stopped. And between the period of 2000 to 2009, the USA lost 6 million manufacturing jobs. The manufacturing renaissance that has been quoted by the financial media over the course of the last decade has tacked back on 1.5 million of those. But we are nowhere near producing the same number of manufacturing jobs today that we had then. Now, one of the reasons why this has only become an issue in the last decade is because what people did was, if they were no longer employed in manufacturing, they went off and got other jobs. Those other jobs paid less. And a lot of the jobs that have been created, which are in the services business, but not in the services business as in computer programmers, but rather in the services business as waiters, hairdressers, and physical trainers, these people generally tend to get paid much closer to the minimum wage or marginally above it. A lot of those people then, they have seen their living standards decrease. But the asset price inflation that has come as a result of quantitative easing, which was a direct result of that policy, well, that has then contributed to the lowering of living standards, the hollowing out of the middle class, and the absence of those kinds of better paying manufacturing jobs has created this widening gap between the rich and the poor, which is creating populist upwellings all over the world. Of course, the beneficiary of this transition has been the emerging markets, most particularly China. And that is the root of this trade war, because in an attempt to try and level the playing field in terms of competition, because obviously labor costs are much lower elsewhere, but then if you look at energy costs, they are considerably lower in the USA, for example, then regulatory obstacles definitely exist in the West that do not exist in the emerging markets. So that is an additional reason why some industries will never come back. But when you start to see wages rising in places like China, then taxation and all of the assistance that has been provided to companies for years, which is completely out of character with the kind of assistance that can be provided legally in terms of trade deals through the OECD and the WTO, well, then that's obviously a very clear change. China has got a long-term aim of becoming the global hegemon. They want to be the largest economy in the world with the most impressive military, and they also want to dominate international trade and geopolitics. And obviously that represents a very clear threat. Well, the region that is most at risk in terms of, or I guess the region that's most in play through this competition between the USA and China is Europe. The UK is courting China for the financial services sector and the renminbi internationalization. Germany is courting China for its market for automotive vehicles and engineering products. France and Italy are courting China for food exports, for luxury goods exports, and for engineering exports. The USA is now starting to court Europe for sales of its natural gas. And that's a very significant change. One of the reasons why Europe and America have been aligned in the NATO organization since the Second World War was because of a shared vision for the free society. But money also played a significant part in that. The fact that the USA has backstopped their militaries, which has allowed them to invest in their own economies in Europe, has also been a significant fact. The fact that the USA has been and continues to run a trade imbalance with Europe has also been to Europe's benefit. But now it is China that is filling that space and running a trade deficit with Europe. Well, therefore, Europe is beholden to China. And there's a competition now going on between the loyalties that Europe has to its allies, but then also to its economic future. So Europe is now very much in play geopolitically. And if this trade war persists, well, Europe is going to find itself trying to sit on the fence between two competing powers. And that is going to be an increasingly taut relationship, I suspect. What we've seen in here today was China moved aggressively following the imposition of an additional 15% tariff to support its stock market, and we had an upside key reversal. That is occurring from the region of the trend mean, and what this really helps to ram home is the point that bull markets in China are state-sponsored, and we definitely saw some state sponsorship of the A-share market in here today. The other thing that we're seeing is that the renminbi is starting to weaken. And we've certainly seen over the course of the majority of 2018, following the imposition of a 10% tariff, the renminbi devalued by about 10%. Well, with an additional 15% now tacked on to $200 billion worth of imports, then there is at least the potential that the renminbi is going to weaken back towards 7. But for it to weaken beyond 7, we're going to have to see a very significant intensification of the trade war. Because if China allows the renminbi to weaken very much beyond 7, they're going to have two significant problems. The first is going to be capital flight. China has got a slowing economy. China is now allowing defaults. The number of defaults in the first quarter of this year was triple that of the first quarter of 2018. They're looking at, if the trend persists, a default rate of about $20 billion in 2019. That's still rather small compared to the size of the $2 trillion size of the domestic corporate bond markets. But it is likely to increase. The one thing we do not know, and it is something that we cannot know, is what is the natural default rate for Chinese corporate bonds. Since they were never allowing defaults previously, we simply don't know what the ultimate default rate is going to be and what it will normalize at after a crisis. China, therefore, has to ensure that it does not fall victim to capital flight, because the problems that China has with slowing growth and with the mountain of debt that has been created as a result of the property boom, then that can be dealt with provided they can mobilize the nation's savings, both in terms of government savings and private sector savings. But if private sector savings start leaving the country in numbers, then that represents a very significant challenge. That is the kind of thing that would create a crash in the economy. There is no way they're going to allow that to happen. So we can anticipate that in addition to supporting the stock market, and in addition to allowing the renminbi to devalue at least modestly, there are going to be much, much tougher regulations on moving capital in and out of China, most particularly out of China. Well, that is, I think, part of the reason why we're starting to see movement in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was up an additional almost $300 in here today. Now, if we look at this on simply a weekly basis, we had the bubble in 2017, and that crashed in the first 3 months of 2018. Now, the price has pushed back above the trend mean. This is the biggest rally we've seen since the counter trend, the first counter trend rally in 2018. We are back above the trend mean, so therefore this is another uptrend. Now the question, and we've broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It has completed its base formation. It's completed a first step above the base. So now the question is whether it's ever going to come back below $5,000. I think that's a meaningful change. There are, I think, three reasons why it's starting to perform now. The first is that this had been almost entirely a retail-oriented market. And that was why we saw that logarithmic scale charts were so appropriate for monitoring the bull market in 2016 and 2017. Because people who were investing in Bitcoin were doing so on a percentage basis, then the size of the reactions was very similar in terms of percentage moves. Of course, in nominal terms, these reactions were very large, but in percentages, then they were all reasonably similar. The first time we saw a very much larger pullback in terms of percentages was right from the peak, and then we broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. That was the end of this bull market. That also corresponded with the introduction of leverage. Well, one of the reasons why the price is doing better now is because the leverage is exiting the market. There is no longer a future that can be traded for Bitcoin. So that's a significant change. Then you have the introduction of the custody for institutional investors through Fidelity and potentially also E*TRADE and JP Morgan. The entire bull market in 2015 through to 2017 was primarily retail driven. Whereas now you're starting to see that institutional investors are beginning to take an interest. And there are two reasons why institutional investors would take an interest. The first is that this is a non-correlated asset. So by buying a non-correlated asset for a diversified portfolio, then you get the diversification and you get the performance. So I think that's a very significant factor. That's certainly going to be one of the reasons why institutional investors want to get a part of it. But then there is also the fact that the price is going up. So you get the momentum factor. The price is up, well, the price has basically doubled in since the lows right at the end of last year. So that is now one of the best performing assets this year. And that's before we even begin to think about what the longer term implications are of a significant rollout of 5G and what that could do for the cryptocurrency market. One of the biggest concerns that people have about 5G is hacking. And that is why there is this continued acrimonious dispute between Huawei, or between China and the USA with regard to Huawei. Well, one of the reasons why Huawei is such a challenge is not only has there been some evidence of hacking already through their routers, but it now represents such a large part of the 5G infrastructure market that it is going to quickly surpass 50% of the global market. And at that point, China will have the ability to dictate the conventions for future innovation in terms of communication infrastructure. Now, that represents a really significant threat to the US dominance of that sector, and that is one of the primary reasons why we're seeing continued stress in the sector. But Bitcoin is potentially just at the dawn of a recovery. I continue to think that there are going to be other cryptocurrencies do better, most particularly those that are focusing on fast payment methods. One of the things I find interesting is that Visa, for example, or MasterCard have got the market in fast payment processing very much dominated at present. Ant Financial, which is run by Alibaba, has got processing powers that are 10 times faster than Visa. Well, Bitcoin and the potential, for example, of IOTA is that it will be somewhere in between when we get more commercial products being launched. Now, that's a very significant issue. One of the things that one of the key words that is coming to bear on the cryptocurrency world is trust. That is where you create markets. One of the reasons why you need regulation, why you need enforcement and reportability and law is because of a lack of trust. The creation of public ledgers, which are cryptographically impervious to change, well, that introduces a trust mechanism that has got the really clear potential to disrupt. But probably not until we see a really important product offering come through that can really start to capture the imagination of investors. It is very similar to the speed of dial-up internet when and how the introduction of broadband changed everything. There is, I think, the potential here that the introduction of 5G is going to have the same kind of change to the cryptocurrency world that broadband did for mobile technology, search, and online shopping. So there is seriously the potential that the recovery that we're now starting to see in the cryptocurrency world is going to be the beginning of the next phase of this bull market. Now, what are the risks? Well, the risks are that this significant change we've had in terms of geopolitics becomes a headwind to global growth, that we move into a much more pronounced multipolar world. So that's the clear risk, and I think it's not simply a risk, but I think it's the most likely scenario. Eventually, we're going to see that this 10-year bull market that has been thriving on access to liquidity is going to run out of liquidity. So we do need to pay attention to the liquidity measures. Now, when we look at the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, it has contracted over the course of the last 18 months, and that contraction is going to end in September. Now, that removes a headwind to growth. When we look at the size of the ECB's balance sheet, well, they stopped their quantitative easing program at the end of last year, and so far it has held reasonably steady, so they're not contracting it. The Bank of Japan is the only central bank right now that is continuing to expand the size of its balance sheet. Against that background, we have the provision of deficits. And the quantity of money that has been pushed into the global market because of deficit creation has been rather significant over the course of the last few months. Now, one of the problems with trying to measure this is that we get very spotty data, and that countries reporting their deficits they do so at different times and with different lags. So what we saw last week was that there was a very significant $800 billion provision, and with the most latest data reading that has contracted. But deficit spending does represent a very significant source of liquidity into this market. The fact that China is supporting its market through fiscal stimulus is an additional powerful influence on global liquidity measures. The size of the Fed's balance sheet and its willingness to contract it has also been a very profound influence on the dollar. The US dollar is still the global reserve currency, and when dollars are scarce, then that pushes up the value of the dollar, but it reduces the availability of liquidity in the global economy. Now, the dollar has continued to range higher in a choppy manner over the course of the last 6 months. When we look at this market over the course of a very long time frame, then we can see that it is capable of putting in periods of clear outperformance. And we most recently saw a very lengthy period of outperformance between approximately 1995 and 2001. So that was a good 6 year advance. Then previous to that, it was between 1979 and 1984. So we had a 5 year advance. Now, the bottom that we saw in 2008 and the peak that we saw in 2016 was an 8 year advance. But we've had a very significant interlocution in the meantime. Now the bigger question is whether the index is going to manage to get back up to 100. When we consider the fact that the Federal Reserve is going to stop decreasing the size of its balance sheet by September, that does call into question the ability of the index to continue to rally. And if the dollar does start to deteriorate in value, then that is going to start to increase liquidity measures for the global economy. So that's also a very significant potential tailwind for the economy. When we look at the Treasury futures market, well, we are presented with an uptrend. Now, Treasuries were not quite able to hold all of the advance in here today. But when we look at this trend over the course of the last decade, there was a clear downtrend in prices between 2016 and the end of 2018. And we have had a meaningful move on the upside since the end of last year, with the price finding support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range as recently as April. And it's going to require a sustained move at least below that level, and probably by the time it gets there, the region of the trend mean, in order to break that uptrend and suggest that we are back on a tightening bias, or that interest rates are likely to head higher. And the one significant bearish argument that would fulfill that is there is a wall of additional debt that needs to be refinanced over the course of the next couple of years. But the very fact that that wall of debt exists inhibits the ability of the Federal Reserve to raise rates. And that, I think, is one of the things that is contributing to this strength in the bond prices. Because every time even though, for example, this week what we saw was that we had one of the bond auctions from the Treasury had the fewest bids for new bonds in a decade. So there is some evidence of resistance to accept at the yield at today's levels. But when we think about the fact that people are worried about the impact that the trade war will have on profitability of companies and the potential that it is going to create inflation in the US economy, then that is something that could have a material effect on the market. So the big question now is whether this upside key reversal in the S&P 500 is going to see follow through next week. We have had a great deal of stress about the trade war, but it is in the interests of China to deal now. They have a long-term objective of becoming the global hegemon. And in order to do that, they need to avoid a recession. They need to continue to develop the technology-led move and investment trend that has persisted for the last decade. And that would be a lot easier if they deal now. That doesn't mean that competition with China is going to evaporate, or that we're not going to have a further iteration of this trade problem later. But China is not yet ready to challenge the USA economically or militarily. 10 years from now, it probably will be. But we're just not there yet. It is in China's interests to sign a deal today so that they can protect their longer-term objective. And China has got a long history of pursuing these long-term objectives. When we look at the USA, well then, the one thing we know that politicians want more than anything else is to get re-elected. And President Trump has got little chance of being re-elected if there's a recession in the USA. Well, that is a clear incentive to get a deal. Now, the bigger question is whether they can get the deal. So the upside key that we're seeing in the S&P 500 right now does suggest that enthusiasm about the potential for a deal has increased. The Dow Jones, for example, is right in the region of its trend mean, and it was able to squeeze out a positive performance in here today. The NASDAQ 100 has got ample space in which to consolidate. So that does look like it is going to happen, that we're going to get some additional pause here. But if we go back and think about what are the motivating factors behind this bull market that's persisted for the last decade, it has been liquidity provision. Well, the Federal Reserve is going to stop reducing the size of its balance sheet, and they've already stopped raising interest rates. Generally speaking, it is when the Federal Reserve goes on pause that stock markets go into the mania phase. So there is a clear potential that we are at the dawn of the mania phase of the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. It's when they then start to either raise rates further and really start to withdraw the punch bowl that you're going to see liquidity tighten again. Then that's when you could anticipate that high yield spreads would start to rise again. But high yield spreads are still reasonably well contained, although we did see a pop on the upside in here this week. The yield curve spread is also really very tight, but it is back around the 20 basis point level. It is not yet inverted, although parts of the yield curve have become inverted. So that is a testament to the fact that liquidity was tight. What has generally spelled trouble for markets is when the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, because they're data dependent, because they would not do that unless they had clear evidence of a slowing economy. Then that is taken as a clear indication that there's a very sustained risk of a recession, so people vote with their feet. If we get a trade deal over the line, then that is likely to be a very bullish catalyst for markets. it could potentially be the catalyst that will send us into the third psychological, or the end of the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. It's likely to be driven by the technology sector. Just this week, we've seen that we've had Uber, which just had its IPO in here today. They priced at the lower side of the range, and the share price closed down on the day about $3. So that is a source of new supply coming to the market. These companies benefited from the provision of massive sums of liquidity. So it isn't simply that liquidity has helped to fuel the bull market in the public markets. It has fueled an asset price inflation everywhere. When that liquidity infusion ends, then it is going to have a profound effect on all asset prices. So we do have to pay attention to the liquidity measures. We do have to pay attention to what central banks are doing. We also have to pay attention to what central banks are doing in response to geopolitical events. 10 years ago, we didn't really have to worry about geopolitics because there was essentially world peace after the end of the Cold War. Well, the chances are that we are moving now into a much more competitive geopolitical environment, and that does represent a challenge for markets. But in the meantime, I think there is the potential that we are going to get a deal done in terms of the trade war, and we're seeing reversions to the mean in terms of the major stock markets. Well, therefore, this is a very pivotal time to pay attention to the consistency of trends. There are a significant number of markets that have already broken on the upside, and these are, generally speaking, the big international companies, those that have got security in terms of their cash flows, or those that have been able to generate income through the subscription business model. And I think that is also a very clear change that we've seen in this market. Secular bull markets thrive on the provision of liquidity. They thrive on the kind of productivity growth that we can get from new technology. They also thrive on lower energy prices, which remove a headwind to growth, and the introduction of billions of new consumers because of demographics. Bull markets also thrive because of the invention of new business models. And the subscription business model is the business model that has characterized this bull market, and it is likely to persist. It is basically transforming highly cyclical sectors into the kinds of cash flow, predictable businesses that are usually associated with consumer staples. And that's a profound change because with technology, you're getting the growth from technology, the margin, the high margins from technology, but the reliability of cash flows that you would associate with a utility or consumer staples. And that is highly attractive to investors. That is the reason why we're continuing to see continued demand for these kinds of companies. So we're at an incredibly exciting time. There is absolutely no question that there are challenges. There is no question that we are late in the medium-term cycle. But we are not late in the long-term cycle. In fact, we're probably not even halfway through the long-term cycle. So what that suggests is we do have to be aware of when the next recession hits. There is going to be a reckoning for the kinds of companies that don't make any money and have been siphoning off liquidity from savers for years. Those kinds of companies will face a reckoning during the next recession. But that is unlikely to really question the integrity of the secular bull market. It is probably going to represent the ultimate change in the global relationship will probably be about 10 years from now when China is ready to compete against the major economic and military powers of the world. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.